There are the private emails, the social media accounts, online bank accounts, even digital music libraries. What do you know about your digital property, your digital assets, as they're called? And what on earth will become of them once you die? It's a question we're asking here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. How can you make sure your loved ones can get into all of your accounts? At the same time, how do you protect your privacy? Simpson Garfinkel thinks about this a lot. His new book is The Computer Book, From the Abacus to Artificial Intelligence, 250 Milestones in the History of Computer Science. He is an adjunct professor of digital studies at George Mason University, and his recent piece in MIT Technology Review is called Six Things to Do with Your Data Before You Die. Simpson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, how are we doing with our wills and the integration of all of the digital things we have in our lives?
Well, for most people in the United States, that's not an issue because they don't have wills, unfortunately, which is a problem, but they don't have to worry about the integration. It turns out that if you have digital artifacts, online accounts, if you have home accounts, if you have data on your phone or data on your computer, you really have to worry about or think about what's going to happen with that information after you die if you care about the people that you would leave behind. If you don't care about those people, then you don't need to make plans. But it's very similar to what you have to do for other things that you might leave behind, whether it might be family members or possessions or cash.
What is a digital estate? What makes up a digital estate?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. There's no legal definition right now. There aren't any laws that I'm aware of that really cover this. For me, my digital estate would include the data on my computers, which of course is all encrypted because I use full disk encryption. It would include data that's in my house on hard drives. Most of those are encrypted, but some of them aren't. Data on CD-ROMs and DVDs. But it also includes information I have in the cloud. So it includes information on Facebook, and I have lots of photographs on Facebook, and I have things that I've written on Facebook. I used to use a service called LiveJournal, so that account is still there, and some of the postings are public, some of them are friends only, some of them are private. I own that account, but what happens with the information on the account would actually depend on both practice, and it would depend upon their terms of service document, but it also depends upon the whims of how it might be enforced by a customer service rep who answers the phone. As I said, things aren't entirely clear in a lot of places. And to show how that's true, Google and Facebook have very different approaches for how they deal with the data of people who are deceased. Google allows you to set up an account recovery email or somebody who will get control of your account if you stop being active.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook says if you die, nobody owns your data anymore. And if things are private, nobody is allowed to access them.
And that has repercussions as well for loved ones if they want to either look at some messages to try to find out some clues about someone's death or whether they simply want more privacy for the person who's deceased.
Precisely. Let's be clear. Under U.S. law, people who are deceased don't have a right to privacy. That goes with you. Facebook claims that those private messages are protecting the privacy of the other party of the message. But Facebook may also be protecting themselves. There's a case in Germany of a girl who died. She fell in front of a subway car, and it wasn't clear whether it was an accident or whether she was depressed or whether she was the victim of cyberbullying. Her parents tried to get access to her Facebook account, and it went through the German courts. And the parents were never able to get that access.
We're talking with Simpson Garfinkel. He is the author of the book, The Computer Book, From the Abacus to Artificial Intelligence, 250 Milestones in the History of Computer Science. We're talking to him about what happens to our data after we pass and how to ensure that it is going to people, to our kin, in the right way. You can join in the conversation with your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you thinking about your digital legacy? Do you have a plan? Do you have passwords in a safe place for a loved one? Have you made a plan? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Simpson, let's talk a little bit about encryption. It used to be that if someone left behind their laptop or even a smartphone after death, or a dumb phone either, surviving relatives could easily gain access to it. They could get into it. What has changed there?
So companies like Apple and Google have moved to device encryption so that if your device is stolen, the thief won't be able to have access to it. And that's especially important for businesses where a stolen device might compromise the privacy or the security of thousands of people. It's important for individuals if you're worried about somebody breaking into your house and they steal your computer, you don't want them to have access to all of your financial records because then they might try to steal those pieces of information. But the same technology that prevents a thief from accessing your device's data would also prevent a loved one from accessing it after you die unless they know how to get in. And that means that they need to have the password or they need to have some other mechanism for getting access to the data.
In your piece, you talked about writing down on paper your password, sealing it in an envelope, putting it in a safe place, and letting that person know where it is. Is that a good plan?
So the sealed envelope is a technique that goes back decades. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of it is that you can tell if somebody's opened the envelope because it's been ripped. So, you know, typically you sign across the envelope's back flap. And when I had a company in the 90s, we gave copies of our encryption keys to our attorney who kept it in their file. But a lot of people don't do that. It's not something that there's a lot of instructions to do.
Is it as simple as making sure they have access to passwords, or is it more complicated than that?
It's becoming more complicated because of the use of multi-factor authentication. So if you're protecting an online account with both a password and a second factor, and then you die, the people who need to get access to your account need both the password and that second factor. So that can be a problem if the second factor is tied to a phone number that gets disconnected, or if it's a physical token that you were carrying around with you when maybe you got hit by a car and it was destroyed, or if you are just lost and never turn up.
So you're saying as well that there you have this multiple ways to get in and passwords aren't the only way. What is a digital backdoor, very quickly here before we go to break?
So digital backdoor is the term that we use for some way of circumventing the protection mechanisms. And that could be a password that's in an envelope, or it could be another technique that would bypass the password.
We're talking with Simpson Garfinkel. He's author of The Computer Book. A loved one's family may lack clear directions to accessing digital assets of the deceased. Sometimes even getting access to these accounts could take a complicated legal process, like going through probate. We're talking about how to manage the future of your digital property once you die here on The Morning Show. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do your next of kin know the passwords to your personal computer or smartphone? Do you plan on telling them? Let's talk about it. Call in or tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. Thank you. What happens to your email and social media after you die? Estate planning now means making a plan for how you manage your virtual legacy, like your Facebook account, your family's digital photo album, your personal email inbox, and a lot more. This may mean reading the terms and conditions of each site you deal with to find out what can be done with your online self after you pass. We're learning about this on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Simpson Garfinkel is author of the new book, The Computer Book. You can join in with your questions, your plan at 800-642-1234. Do you want next of kin to have access to your social media accounts? What about other things like email, personal photos, and your work correspondence? Do you think about how it should be handled? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Simpson, another issue here is medical records. Our physicians keep track of our medical records. There are elaborate systems now in place for online medical records. So why do we need to duplicate this ourselves?
So that is an open question. I believe that you should keep copies of your medical records so that if you need to provide them to another physician, you can do that. My father keeps around a copy of his medical records on a USB drive with him so that if he has an accident, the rescue people can see his medical records. I found that many times it's easier for me to give medical records to another doctor than to make them get it from doctor to doctor. There's also issues where when you have children, it's very important for children to have the medical records for their biological parents because so many diseases have an inherited component. And it may be difficult to get medical records after someone has died. So recently we did this for a family member, my wife, and it was actually quite difficult to get all of her parents' medical records because they'd been dead for so long. And we weren't able to get them all.
So because she couldn't, what were some of the barriers there?
So things get lost. Hospitals merge. Hospitals go out of business. Some have records retention policies that might cause those old records to be destroyed. The best way to be sure that you have them is to have them, rather than to rely on other people to keep them. But of course, if you have them, then that means that you have a security burden. You have to be sure that you both maintain them, that you can find them, and that they can't be misused. Now, in the case of medical records, the misuse is usually about revealing them to people who you don't want that information revealed to.
Looking at how we keep our passwords today, it seems like we're continually asked to change a password. I changed one yesterday. What about password managers and those ways we can just kind of deposit all our passwords in one place like LastPass? What do you think of them?
So most security experts will recommend that both businesses and individuals have password managers. LastPass is one. 1Password is another one. Some of them are better than others, and it's important that you use one that's been vetted by security experts. And most of the magazines have now written articles about the more reliable password managers. Both LastPass and 1Password have the ability to do password delegation, where you can share passwords between multiple users and you can give another user access to a password. So my wife and I have a shared password manager, and then we actually have the family version. So all of our children have the ability to use that for managing passwords as well. And it's important with your password manager that you be able to back up all your passwords and store them somewhere else. But it's important that those passwords themselves be encrypted with a key, so that neither somebody who doesn't have your interests or even the password manager company itself can't get access to them.
So it sounds like a password manager type system would be a pretty efficient, clean way to keep your digital affairs pretty tidy after you die.
It is, provided that your loved ones know the master password that you use for the password manager. The 1Password system, which is the one that I use, has both a master password and then another password, and it encrypts your data with both of them. And that second password has to be explicitly moved from device to device. That's a way that it gets additional security, but it's also a barrier if when you need extraordinary access.
Looking at how we use two-factor authentication today with increased security, hard to say, how can we avoid giving out our phone numbers?
So you shouldn't. There are many people who are using an SMS message to a phone as their second factor. Uh-huh. And one of the problems with that is that it's easy for thieves to steal a phone number. They can pretend to be you and go into a store and use a fake ID or do it over the phone and actually have your phone number moved to another device. And this happened to a person named Lori Craner, who was the chief technology officer at the Federal Trade Commission, uh-huh. And she wrote a blog post about it. And just one day, her cell phone stopped working. So the best thing you can do is make sure that set phone numbers aren't used for fallback authentication and aren't used for your second factor. Now, what you can do is you can have an app that runs on your cell phone, and Google Authenticator is such an app. But then there's a secret that's on your phone, and it engages in a protocol with the remote website, but it's not that somebody sends you an SMS message and you can reset your password that way.
We're talking with Simpson Garfinkel, and he wrote the book, The Computer Book. We're talking about our digital assets, what to do with them, and how to get them in order before we die. Simpson, social media, what do we need to consider when it comes to giving access to our next of kin, if that's something we want to do in terms of our social media accounts?
Yeah, so the first thing is that before you give access to somebody else, either while you're alive or while you're dead, you need to be sure that you want them actually to have access to all that data. And in the article that we wrote in Technology Review magazine, one of the professors that I interviewed said that he had a friend who her husband had died, and she finally broke into his account, and she discovered things about him that she really didn't want to know. So in general, there's that old rule, if you don't want somebody to know something, don't put it on a computer. If you don't want people to see information that you've been hoarding, it's better not to hoard that information. But after that, then with social media, you should know that Facebook and Google have very different policies. And if you're using Google, it's good to have an account recovery email address. And they have a lot of instructions on how to set that up. And if you're using Facebook, you should be aware that what their terms are. You can specify a person who can manage the account after you die. But it's a good idea to make sure that Facebook isn't your only copy of anything, because as they have it currently constructed, your family, your estate will probably lose access to that information after you pass.
Simpson, if you could give us one thing we could do today to better manage our digital assets and prepare them for us, what would be that one thing we could do, a step in the right direction?
So I think everybody should use a password manager, and there are several good ones out there. And I think that everybody should be using two-factor. So although the digital death is a really important thing to focus on, many of the protections that will protect your family members will also help you lead a more secure, more safe life online. And those are things that we all can do.
The last piece of advice you have is interesting. Be careful what you wish for. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said, that was the story of the woman who got access to her husband's files after he died, and she found material in the files that really disturbed her and permanently changed her opinion of her husband, which is unfortunate because he died, right? And it would be nice if she had been left with good feelings instead of these tinged feelings afterwards.
It starts to feel overwhelming when we look at our digital footprint and how much of ourselves is out there on the cloud, on social media accounts, online banking. Our digital footprint is growing bigger and bigger every day. Is there a way we can truly keep this in order? Is there a way to have a tidy digital legacy?
Yeah. So I recommend that people try to keep their online presence and their devices as simple as possible, rather than having like 10 or 20 accounts and trying to keep them all straight. Just have a very small number and protect it well and have it backed up offline, so that even if all of your accounts are compromised, you still have a copy of your data. It's so easy to back things up now. You can get a hard drive that plugs into a laptop for less than $100 that stores 4 terabytes of data, and just use that as a backup so that you don't have just one copy in either in the cloud or at home.
Simpson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Simpson Garfinkel is author of the book, The Computer Book, and we've been talking about our digital assets. He's an adjunct professor of digital studies at George Mason University. Coming up, we talked to Representative Mike Gallagher of the 8th Congressional District. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.